It's your first impression, and they're very important. We wouldn't make our reception area look terrible. So in a way, why would you make your packaging look terrible or not put any effort into that?
Monocle's founding creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, there on the importance of good packaging.
You could do a beautiful invite with white paper and black ink. You can be very simple and still be very elegant. So I guess it just depends how you want to pitch your product.
We'll unwrap the art of packaging today, right here on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also today...
When you put exactly the same perfume in a blue bottle or a red bottle, no one will smell it the same way. So our eye is the boss.
We'll find out how perfumer Rami McDaki's distinctive brand, Lola James Harper, caught eyes with its brown glass candles and what it means to be seen around the world in high-end department stores. Plus...
You can't grow a business on fast-moving consumer furniture. It doesn't work like that. We need to deliver great stuff that lasts, that people want to fall in love with.
We'll take a seat in Vitra's next-generation office chair and meet British design duo Edward Barber and Jay Osgoby. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now we'll start today with a breath of fresh air, or is it the whiff of a vinyl store? Candles named The TV Basement of Jonnet and fragrances inspired by coffee shops are the remit of Lola James Harper, a brand that's attracted a dedicated following for its evocative olfactory delights. So how do you transform a sensory experience into a tangible one? Well, when your product makes it onto the shelves of Parisian department store Colette, amongst others, you know you're probably doing something right. This is what happened to fragrance brand Lola James Harper, thanks to its distinctive brown glass packaging and minimally designed labels. Monocle's Jamie Waters caught up with the man behind the brand, Rami McDaki, to find out more.
I began my life playing music and taking pictures. Really, that's what I used to do when I was a teenager. Really, playing music with lots of bands and taking pictures and beginning to understand what is movie theaters, what is the cinema. That was really my first background, and that part of art was my love of art. And I did my studies in marketing, and then I worked in perfume business that for me was really close to art in marketing and products, because you really talk about poetry, about memories, and you use lots of pictures, lots of music, lots of words. It's really an amazing field that encapsulating art forms to make it products and memories. So I began to develop in that field using what I have done when I was a teenager. And I began to realize year after year how amazing is the interaction between the sound, the image, the smells. When you work on perfume, but also when you begin to have that knowledge, you realize how thinking about a perfume and its story, it's like thinking of a song and its story. It's like thinking of a abstract or a picture and what it gives to people. So there's something really linked. So really, that was my art background. And the other background that is super important for me is family and friends. Whatever I have done, I work with my wife. I always travel with my kids and my wife. And anything I have done, I mean, coffee shops or restaurant, different project I held, or even surf project or picture project, are always with friends. So the first things that count for me is not the skills of people, is who the people are. So this is now that I'm 46, I realize that's how things happened for me for 25 years.
On the Lola James Harper website, it's, I guess, this like platform, would you say, and you've kind of collected, as you say, like all these, the candles, the eau de toilette, and then there's also music. You wanted to create this kind of whole lifestyle experience for consumers. And on that point, I wondered, is that because people, when they're looking to buy or looking to consume things, they want full experiences now? They don't just want a product. Is that kind of what people are looking for?
Things have really changed the last 5 years. It's been decades that anything has been created by product and industrial people. If I can take an example, I could say that a few decades ago, a guy used to do a cigarette as an industrial person. And he said, okay, I want to sell my cigarette. How could I do? Oh, I'm going to put it in the mouth of a cowboy. And then people, because they want to be free like a cowboy, they're going to buy the cigarette. But the idea was coming from an industrial person, a product person. And when somebody was doing pants or clothes, he add to it a lifestyle. He pay people that have a lifestyle. And he say to other people, if you want to have that lifestyle, buy that product. Things are changing now because people are super educated and now they don't want to talk about product. They want to talk about meaning, philosophy and sense in life. So when you come to a brand, it's because about what she offers as a lifestyle and as a way of thinking, as a way of living.
How important do you think is the packaging of a perfume or other products? How important is that as part of the kind of process?
Packaging, in fact, is super important because it's the first thing that gives you an idea of what will come to you. What I mean is when you put the same perfume, exactly the same perfume, in a blue bottle or a red bottle, no one will smell it the same way. I mean, believe me, you put it the same one on a red bottle, he will begin to say, oh, there are spices. You put it in a blue bottle, he will say, oh, there is like a water smell. Or in a green bottle, oh, there are... You see what I mean? So our eye is the boss. We need to know that our eye is the boss. It's the one that we use the most. Our smell is really... We don't use it enough. You know, for that reason, I want to put it up. The ears also, because of all the noise around us, we just begin to a bit close our ears. So the eye is the one that we use a lot. And whenever we see something, before even tasting it, before even talking to a person, we have huge amount of ideas about it. And this is super important to know. So for that reason, for example, I know that Lola James Harper is a super modern and I mean, it's a high brand that people love. So I decided that I want to do super classical perfume. Because I love to create a huge gap between what you see and what you have, because it creates poetry and it leaves more space for imagination. When you are super modern, I don't think that you should do super modern perfumes. When you are super classical, I don't think you should, as a brand, you shouldn't do a super classical perfume. I love the idea that you have a super modern project, an arty like Lola James, but when you take our perfume to a professional perfumer, we're talking of classical perfumery. You know, it's really an amazing rose and an amazing iris. It's an orange blossom, super well composed with Benoît Lapouzat and Pierre Bourdon. It's amazing perfumers. And I love this idea. So packaging, is it important or not? What I can say is that it gives you an idea. Then when you know what people have in mind, play with the second field, that is the smell. But consider that the first step is that, and you want to bring them to the second step there. It's super important to know how things are working, yes.
When you say modern branding, so it's that very clean, like black text on a white background, that's kind of the...
Then the graphism is something else. When I say it about modern brand, I'm talking about the lifestyle. When somebody talks about Lola James Harper, they think of skate, West Coast, or you know, the sun and the rock music. We're not talking of something that is, of the 30s or... So we know it's modern. About the graphism and the design, for me it was important to have in the design, because half of our project is about collaboration. So the way I created the logo is to be able to write always with an other brand. So there is Lola James Harper, a number, and always in the center we can write our story or the brand of others. Because, I mean, we have almost more collaboration candles than our own. You know, we have like 40 collab candles and we have 18 for us. And I love the idea when I meet, we're doing with Oyuna. Oyuna is an amazing cashmere brand. An amazing woman, and she comes from Mongolia, and it's really amazing. It's all in some Bon Marché, Selfridges and everything. And we're going to do a huge family blanket for Christmas to watch TV with the parents and the kids. And we're going to do a candle about cashmere. So whenever I meet someone, they came to us, and she's really, it's a charismatic woman and super sweet. And the idea that we meet, we do one product together and one candle. In my logo, whenever I meet brands, it's there. It takes 2 seconds to put their brand in the center, because there is a number down, my brand up, and the space in the middle to put all the people I love to work with. So graphism, before being a way to see, it was symbolically, it leaves a huge space for collab. That was super important for me when I began working on the graphism. It's like, okay, my name is small, the number express when it happens chronologically, but I want to leave a space to the others.
And that was Rami Mukdaki speaking to Monocle's Jamie Waters there. And I'm joined now in studio by Monocle's very own founding creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. Not often we see you down here in the studio, but thank you very much for joining us on Section D.
Welcome.
I got you in here because you and I have a discussion every single month about the subject of this show, about packaging, and this is in the inventory section of the magazine. And the products, a lot of times it's industrial design, but sometimes it is just an eye-catching, interesting piece of packaging that we choose to showcase. And I was wondering if you could tell us, as the creative eye of the magazine, what is it you look for? I mean, what is the actual importance of a piece of packaging? Surely it's there just to be thrown away.
Yeah, packaging is a funny one, because you want to apply the same principles as you do as a graphic designer that you would to designing a magazine or an album cover or, you know, a record, a front cover of a magazine, a website page. All those things all have the same kind of, you always have the same kind of approach. But packaging, you kind of get excited about it because you think it's a really interesting subject, but inevitably it kind of goes in the bin. So it's funny, you put a lot of effort, sometimes a lot of money in terms of finishing and folds, and they're expensive things to make, packaging. And you know, ultimately, it gets thrown away. So yeah, it's quite an interesting design challenge. And I look for the things that I think I look for in nice wine bottles, or I don't know what, nice film posters. You still want to see those sort of lush graphic things, but sometimes the packaging is there to sort of seduce you a little bit. So you have to be a little bit cautious that it's the thing inside the box that you're buying, not the box itself.
Well, that's particularly true with food, and we'll maybe come to that in a second. But just thinking about Monocle's products, I mean, when we do collaborations with brands we like, quite often people will, for the first time, see that product in packaging. You know, how important is it to keeping a brand identity? Can you make a wonderful product that's thought through, that's sourced with amazing provenance, and then pop it in a bit of crap packaging and expect people to get what you're on about? Is it more important to communicating, I guess?
I think it depends, because I think, you know, I don't know, about 10 years ago, or maybe sooner than that, there was a bit of a kind of return to lo-fi in graphics and packaging. Suddenly, you know, brown manila board with a bit of white screen print was as chic as anything. And, you know, very glossy, laminated stuff seemed a bit naff. So I think you can do it both ways. It just depends on how sensitive the design is, really. And I think if it's well designed, it can be done in a glossy way and in a kind of a lo-fi way. So that's a bit of a non-answer, really. But I just think you can make something, you can do a beautiful invite with white paper and black ink. You don't have to foil it. You don't have to emboss it and twist it and fold it and stick it in an envelope that's like as thick as plywood. You can be very simple and still be very elegant. So I guess it just depends how you want to pitch your product. But I would say one thing about nicely designed packaging, obviously, if you are seeing it for the first time, it's your first impression. And, you know, first impressions we've talked about a lot, and they're very important. We wouldn't make our reception area look terrible. So in a way, why would you make your packaging look terrible or not put any effort into that, even though you know it's going to be put in the bin potentially?
And let's go into a little case study here. I know you're busy designing the forthcoming weekly newspaper for Monocle, so seconds do count. But let's talk a little bit about iPhone packaging, or Apple's kind of take on things, because that is a fairly lush experience, isn't it? The way that the two boxes slide apart, the little indent of plastic which holds the phone. And as you mentioned in the chat that we had before we came on air, this is something that people actually keep. There's no purpose for it, and they can't do anything with it, unlike the phone. But, you know, how has that helped brands such as Apple really cement their cause as design-minded companies?
Well, obviously, Apple's very famous about the effort they put into everything. But what they've ended up, interestingly, is a black screen. And that's it, pretty much. All their products are black screen. They've kind of reduced it and reduced it and reduced it to absolutely nothing. So when you get their packaging, it is simply a white box that, if rumour's true, they developed the iPhone box, so that when you hold it up and it gravity automatically opens it for you. It takes 7 seconds for the bottom tray to fall out from the top tray. And they spent, you know, months and months, you know, trying to work out how to do that. So that there was still an experience that was you could get from two pieces of cardboard. So obviously they've put a lot of effort into something that is crazy if that goes straight in the dustbin. And, you know, Apple's a, you know, has got an enormous fan base, as we know. People probably keep those boxes. I wouldn't be surprised if you can buy iPod One packaging on eBay for, God knows, you know, goodness knows how much money. But yeah, I mean, when you actually look at the graphic design that went into it, it's almost nothing. It's a white box with an embossed logo. I mean, if you were the art director of that, I mean, I would love that amount of responsibility. Just where does the logo go? In the middle, white on white, done, let's go home.
And tell me, do you think there's enough fun and levity in packaging? I mean, I'm thinking a little bit about food packaging here, but people are trying to signify to consumers that the way that we consume things has changed and, you know, we've put this together, we really care about where it comes from. Here's a picture of the farm. But actually, my eye is drawn, and I think yours too sometimes, to the funny little mascots and to the logos and to the levity, to the, you know, in the most recent issue of the magazine, there's a beautiful little, it's a chili plant cultivation kit, but it's modelled on old rice bags. It's got a cartoony little scrawl on the front and a little tie on top. I mean, we're kind of coming out of an age of sombre packaging where luxury means less, and the iPhone is probably the exemplar of that. Is there room for a bit of fun with packaging, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And you definitely do see it in food packaging. And I always like, you know, whenever you're on holiday and you go into the supermarket and suddenly you see the breakfast cereals are different, the beer labels are different, you know, the Orangina is different. And it always is quite exciting. And I think food packaging is also interesting because we often buy from the packaging. You don't buy an iPhone from seeing the package. You don't buy, you know, many things from actually seeing the box. Like, you know, any tech, you don't really see the box. You don't see a Sony TV box ever until it's, you know, delivered by John Lewis or whatever it is.
Maybe when it's outside on the curbside in Soho or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, with the polystyrene all battered. But with food, you often buy on just the packaging. I mean, wine, for example. Wine is a good example of where, you know, if you're old world versus new world, and if you ever see a new bit of packaging design or label design on a wine bottle, sometimes you're inclined to think, not sure about that. But if it's a bit old fashioned and, wow, they've been making this for 200 years, you think, wow, that's got to taste good. So you can often, you do judge a little bit when you look at food packaging. I always like the stuff that is a little bit older, that isn't a bit anachronistic, and some young guys come in and just thought, okay, let's make a pattern on here and we'll emboss this and gold that and it'll look like we've been around for 50 years, we've only been around for 50 minutes. And so I think the older ones are more interesting, and I like the stuff that hasn't changed for years, the Mars bar logos and, you know, Pocari Sweat from South Korea and, all, you know, Kikkoman soy sauce, all these things that are just staples. I mean, Worcestershire sauce, things like that.
These are the classics. And I'm going to spring one last question on you, Rich. I remember at our conference 2 years ago in Lisbon, we asked the famous modernist architect, Issei Weinfeld, if he could design any building, what would it be? And he said a brothel. But if you could repackage any product or be in charge of the redesign of the identity of it, is there anything that you think is just kind of ripe for reinvention or that is going in the wrong direction or just something you'd like to tweak a little bit and get your hands on?
No brand in particular that I could, you know, that I want to sort of get in there and redo, but I would love to design a beer can. And that's not just I like beer, so I want to design beer cans. I just think there's something nice about the shape, especially the shorter ones. I think there's something about the material, that format that you're up against. Everyone else has got the same packaging, so it's just down to you and what you can do with colour and type or image or, you know, illustration. But it's a little bit like a level playing field. So I think as a competition brief, that one would be quite fun.
A bare knuckle design bout. That was Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now we turn to the story of one long-known packaging design success down under, a smiley yellow-jerseyed amphibian. Today, the Freddo Frog is one of Australia's most popular chocolate treats. He was first produced by the McRobertson Chocolates Company in Melbourne and was invented, fittingly enough, by the portentously named Harry Melbourne when he was just an 18-year-old employee at the company. Over the years, Freddo's outfits have evolved from his simple black cap of the 1930s to a top hat and a dinner suit, and today with a more modern t-shirt and black slacks. Remember, the metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestion. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Rylan. He's on br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. Finally, on the show, we settle in for a little news from the top end of the industrial design world. Swiss firm Vitra has an illustrious history in office furniture, and its most recent unveiling comes courtesy of the talented London-based duo Edward Barber and Jay Osgoby. We were lucky enough to catch up with them at the Vitra showroom in Clerkenwell, London. To learn more about the Pacific office chair, the office of the future, and the state of the industry today, Monocle's Marie-Sophie Schwarzer reports.
It's incredible how much there is to say about a chair, to be honest, especially a chair that looks so calm and straightforward. But I guess that was the starting point of the project. We set out to design Vitra's next generation chair, but we set out for it to be the antidote to the machine that you sit on. For a very long time, the office chair has been an expression of your performance, your task-related job. You know, this the idea, the notion really that you, if you sit on a machine, you'll perform like a machine, you know, without fault, with huge endeavour and precision, etc. But the way that we work has changed so much since that time, you know, since the era of the Aeron chair, let's say. And I think we came to the conclusion that the office chair needs to be, in fact, the antidote to that. In a way, we tried to make a chair that would sit just as comfortably at home as it would at work. Designing what's called a checklist chair is that it has to have all the things that you need, no matter what size you are. You know, if you're a really small person or a real giant heavyweight person, you still have to have support for a really long time at work during the day. And so the chair has to respond to your personal ergonomic requirements. And so that means by necessity, we have to design a chair which looks calm, because that was what we set out to do, but give you total comfort and support throughout the day. And that was something that we thought would be really easy, but actually took 4 years and was pretty much impossible.
Yeah, and I can imagine it's such a challenge because there are so many office chairs already to create a new product that would really stand out.
The trick with the project was applying a reductive design philosophy. So taking all the over-expressiveness of the machine and calming it all down and making something that visually you won't tire of. Create a chair that you could live with for a really, really long time. Like an Eames chair, like an aluminium group, you know, but an aluminium group that's full function, that supports you and for a full day's work. And one of the other objectives that we had, I guess, was to create a chair which was the architect's chair, because so often architects create these beautiful spaces, beautiful workspaces, and then unfortunately have to populate them with these crazy sort of beetle-like, insect-like machines. And so this is the architect's chair, and it seems to have caught on really well with the architects.
There are so many fairs and so many events. Yeah. Is it really difficult? You face a lot of pressure creating so many new products.
In fact, we do a really good job of not producing that many things. Our process is kind of really intense, but actually quite, I'd say, slow compared to lots of our contemporaries. I mean, there are people, other designers that you'll know that produce 800 things a year, and I think we're up to about 8 at the moment. Because we spend a great deal of time getting it right and we don't rush stuff. So although maybe, you know, you and I meet fairly regularly and talk about new things, it isn't such a race for us to produce novelties. And in fact, we'd rather set out to design stuff that people want to keep forever and that lasts forever visually and functionally. And that takes a really bloody long time to do. In fact, the manufacturers that we work with are really frustrated by the demands of the shows, by the demands of the markets for novelties. And in fact, I think that we're probably going to witness a backlash, and I think manufacturers are going to consolidate. All the people we work for produce things that have been widely accepted and lived with for many years already and will go on to be. And it doesn't interest us at all to work with manufacturers that are looking at a quick buck and to chuck stuff out rapidly just for marketing purposes. You know, we want to design great products that people live with forever.
So you think the trend is that things are going to slow down again?
I think they're going to have to. You know, a lot of manufacturers are falling by the wayside too. And I feel sorry for them because there's a degree of being misguided, I think, in their strategy. Because it's all very well getting a couple of pages of editorial coverage for a product, but you can't grow a business on fast-moving consumer furniture. It doesn't work like that. You know, you need to deliver great stuff that lasts, that people want to fall in love with.
Do you have Pacific chairs in your office now?
We do. We finally have. We finally have our own designed office chairs, which is quite a sort of grown-up feeling, really. We've got our own tables and our own chairs and everything in there, in fact, pretty much is ours, which is not something that we would typically do. It's just that maybe this that we got samples from all our supply, from all our manufacturers. Anyway, it feels very relaxed and sort of convivial.
And what about your book? Can you tell me more about that? It's launching in September.
Yes, the book will launch, I think it's the 4th or the 6th of September with Fiden. And we've been working on it for probably 18 months or so. And it's quite a full catalogue of our work, pretty much from day one. And it's got some very nice photography at the front end of it. And then it has a sort of catalogue, I suppose, with descriptions of pretty much every project we've done at the back. And there are a number of essays that have been written by Jana Schultz. And they're based on interviews or conversations, is probably a better way of putting it, with a number of people who are involved in key projects throughout the book. So we have things like the loop table, which was the very first project that we did, and things like the Olympic torch and the Tipton chair for Vitra and so on.
What other projects are you working on at the moment?
I mean, clearly I can't disclose that because I'd have to kill you. But, we are working on a really interesting new project for next year in Orgotech, which is a direct result of our observations about how people are working differently. What I like about the office, I think, is the fact that it's becoming so interconnected with all aspects of life. You know, whether it's working in a hotel lobby all day long, like at the ACE, you know, where it's just ram-packed all day long, or working at home, and the way that, you know, people have, the whole freelancer economy has changed the way that we work. In a way, you seek your colleagues out. So it might be in a hotel lobby, it might be, you know, in a cafe, it might be wherever. But so I like the fact that furniture has had to metamorphose into kind of different characteristics to help accommodate that. And part of that is the fact that they should, most of the things we design, feel at home, and they feel at home at work.
It sounds like there's a party going on upstairs already. We're missing out.
I know. It's the... listen to that, there you go. Who would have thought there'd be so much excitement about an office chair?
Edward Barber and Jay Osgoby there, discussing the new Pacific chair for Vitra. Our special thanks to Marie-Sophie Schwarzer for reporting. Before we depart, a look at some of the other stories we've been watching this week. A new exhibition here in London showcases the very best of architectural designs you're unlikely to experience in real life. Anime Architecture uncovers some of the most envelope-pushing pen strokes from the world of Japanese animation, including the buildings depicted in 1988's Akira and 1995's Ghost in the Shell. The exhibition is at the House of Illustration on Granary Square and runs until September. And if you're in the market for a mid-century desert getaway and have a handsome budget to blow on it, then you might like to consider Palm Springs. Built in 1955 as a small apartment complex, the Amado consists of just 5 rooms, each with kitchens and bathrooms, huddled around a central pool. It spent its recent years playing host to sun-soaked vacationers, but the city's recent crackdown on short-term rentals has prompted the building's owner to put the complex on the market, with an asking price of the princely sum of $1.8 million, if you're interested. Next week, we'll embark on a walking tour of London, thanks to a clever new mapping tool from the Architecture Foundation. Section D was produced by Ben Ryland and edited by the ever-patient Alex Funnell. I'm Josh Fennett, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.